laughing. "You have eaten enough already for a long day's march."
"I thought it was only a kind of cram, such as the Dale men make for journeys in the wild," said the dwarf.
"So it is," they answered. "But we call it lembas, or whey bread, and it is more strengthening than any food made by men, and it is more pleasant than cram, by all accounts."
"Indeed it is," said Gimli. "Why, it's better than the honey cakes of the Beornings, and that is great praise, for the Beornings are the best bakers that I know of. But they are none too willing to deal out their cakes to travellers in these days. You are kindly hosts."
"All the same, we bid you spare the food," they said. "Eat little at a time, and only at need, for these things are given to serve you when all else fails. The cakes will keep sweet for many, many days, if they are unbroken and left in their leaf wrappings, as we've brought them. One will keep a traveller on his feet for a day of long labour, even if he be one of the tall men of Minas Tirith." The elves next unwrapped and gave to each of the company the clothes they had brought. For each they had provided a hood and a cloak, made according to his size, of the light but warm silken stuff that the Galathrim wove. It was hard to say of what colour they were, grey with a hue of twilight under the trees they seemed to be, and yet if they were moved, or set in another light, they were green as shadowed leaves, or brown as fallow fields by night, dusk silver as water under the stars. Each cloak was fastened about the neck with a brooch like a green leaf veined with silver.
"Are these magic cloaks?" asked Pippin, looking at them with wonder.
"I do not know what you mean by that," answered the leader of the elves. "They are fair garments, and the web is good, for it was made in this land. They are elvish robes, certainly, if that is what you mean. Leaf and branch, water and stone, they have the hue and beauty of all these things under the twilight of Lorien that we love, for we put the thought of all that we love into all that we make. Yet they are garments, not armour, and they will not turn shaft or blade. But they should serve you well. They are light to wear, and warm enough or cool enough at need, and you will find them a great aid in keeping out of the sight of unfriendly eyes, whether you walk among the stones or the trees. You are indeed high in the favour of the lady. For she herself and her maidens wove this stuff, and never before have we clad strangers in the garb of our own people." After their morning meal, the company said farewell to the lawn by the fountain. Their hearts were heavy, for it was a fair place, and it had become like home to them, though they could not count the days and nights that they had passed there. As they stood for a moment looking at the white water in the sunlight, Haldir came walking towards them over the green grass of the glade. Frodo greeted him with delight.
"I have returned from the northern fences," said the elf, "and I am sent now to be your guide again. The Dimrill Dale is full of vapour and clouds of smoke, and the mountains are troubled. There are noises in the deeps of the earth. If any of you had thought of returning northwards to your homes, you would not have been able to pass that way. But come, your path now goes south."
As they walked through Carras Galathon, the greenways were empty, but in the trees above them many voices were murmuring and singing. They themselves went silently. At last, Haldir led them down the southward slopes of the hills, and they came again to the great gate hung with lamps, and to the white bridge. And so they passed out and left the city of the elves. Then they turned away from the paved road, and took a path that went off into a deep thicket of mallorn trees, and passed on, winding through rolling woodlands of silver shadow, leading them ever down, southwards and eastwards, towards the shores of the river. They had gone some 10 miles, and noon was at hand, when they came on a high green wall. Passing through an opening, they came suddenly out of the trees. Before them lay a long lawn of shining grass, studded with golden Eleanor that glinted in the sun. The lawn ran out into a narrow tongue between bright margins. On the right and west, The silver load flowed glittering. On the left and east, the great river rolled its broad waters, deep and dark. On the further shores, the woodlands still marched on southwards as far as the eye could see. But all the banks were bleak and bare. No Malorn lifted its gold-hung boughs beyond the land of Lorien. On the bank of the Silver Lode, at some distance up from the meeting of the streams, there was a hithe of white stones and white wood. By it were moored many boats and barges. Some were brightly painted, and shone with silver and gold and green, but most were either white or grey. Three small grey boats had been made ready for the travellers, and in these the elves stowed their goods. And they added also coils of rope, three to each boat. Slender they looked, but strong, silken to the touch, grey of hue like the elven cloaks. "What are these?" asked Sam, handling one that lay upon the greensward. "Ropes, indeed," answered an elf from the boats. "Never travel far without a rope, and one that is long and strong and light. Such are these. They may be a help in many needs." "You don't need to tell me that," said Sam. "I came without any, and I've been worried ever since. But I was wondering what these were made of, knowing a bit about rope-making. It's in the family, as you might say." "They are made of hithaline," said the elf. "But there is no time now to instruct you in the art of their making. Had we known that this craft delighted you, we could have taught you much. But now, alas, unless you should at some time hither return, you must be content with our gift. May it serve you well." "Come," said Haldir. "All is now ready for you. Enter the boats, but take care at first." "Heed the words," said the other elves. "These boats are light-built, and they are crafty, and unlike the boats of other folk, they will not sink. Lade them as you will, but they are wayward if mishandled. It would be wise if you accustom yourselves to stepping in and out. Here, where there is a landing-place, before you set off downstream." The company was arranged in this way. Aragorn, Frodo, and Sam were in one boat. Boromir, Merry, and Pippin in another, and in the third were Legolas and Gimli, who had now become fast friends. In this last boat most of the goods and patch were stowed. The boats were moved and steered with short-handled paddles that had broad leaf-shaped blades. When all was ready, Aragorn led them on a trial up the Silver Lode. The current was swift, and they went forward slowly. Sam sat in the bows, clutching the sides, and looking back wistfully to the shore. The sunlight glittering on the water dazzled his eyes. As they passed beyond the green field of the Tongue, the trees drew down to the river's bank. Here and there golden leaves tossed and floated on the rippling stream. The air was very bright and still, and there was a silence, except for the high, distant song of larks. They turned a sharp bend in the river, and there, sailing proudly down the stream toward them, they saw a swan of great size. The water rippled on either side of the white breast beneath its curving neck. Its beak shone like burnished gold, and its eyes glinted like jet set in yellow stones. Its huge white wings were half lifted. A music came down the river as it drew nearer, and suddenly they perceived that it was a ship, wrought and carved with elven skill in the likeness of a bird. Two elves clad in white steered it with black paddles. In the midst of the vessel sat Celeborn, and behind him stood Galadriel, tall and white. A circlet of golden flowers was in her hair, and in her hand she held a harp, and she sang. Sad and sweet was the sound of her voice in the cool, clear air.
"I sang of leaves of gold, and leaves of gold there grew. Of wind I sang, a wind there came, and in the branches blew. beyond the sun, beyond the moon, the foam was on the sea, and by the strand of Ilmarin there grew a golden tree. Beneath the stars of ever-eve, in Eldamar it shone, in Eldamar, beside the walls of Elventyrion. There long the golden leaves have grown upon the branching years, while here beyond the sundering seas now fall the elven tears. O Lorien, the winter comes, the barren leafless day, the leaves are falling in the stream, the river flows away. O Lorien, too long I have dwelt upon this hither shore, and in a fading crown have twined the golden Eleanor. But if of ships I now should sing, what ship would come to me? What ship would bear me ever back across so wide a sea?
Aragorn stayed his boat as the swan ship drew alongside. The lady ended her song and greeted them. "We have come to bid you our last farewell," she said, "and to speed you with blessings from our land." "Though you have been our guests," said Celeborn, "you have not yet eaten with us, and we bid you, therefore, to a parting feast here between the flowing waters that will bear you far from Lorien." The swan passed on slowly to the Hythe, and they turned their boats and followed it. There in the last end of Egladil, upon the green grass, the parting feast was held. But Frodo ate and drank little, heeding only the beauty of the lady and her voice. She seemed no longer perilous or terrible, nor filled with hidden power. Already she seemed to him, as by men of later days elves still at times are seen, present and yet remote, a living vision of that which has already been left far behind by the flowing streams of time. After they had eaten and drunk, sitting upon the grass, Celeborn spoke to them again of their journey, and lifting his hand he pointed south to the woods beyond the tongue. "As you go down the water," he said, "you will find that the trees will fail, and you will come to a barren country. There the river flows in stony vale amid high moors, until at last, after many leagues, it comes to the tall island of the Tindrock, and that we call Tall Brandir. There it casts its arms about the steep shores of the isle, and falls then with a great noise and smoke over the cataracts of Rauros, down into the Nindalf, the Wetwang, as it is called in your tongue. That is a wide region of sluggish fen, where the stream becomes tortuous and much divided. There the Entwash flows in by many mouths from the forest of Fangorn in the west. About that stream, on this side of the great river, lies Rohan. On the further side are the bleak hills of the Emyn Muil. The wind blows from the east there, for they look out over the dead marshes and the no-man lands to Kirith Gorgor and the black gates of Mordor. Boromir, and any that go with him seeking Minas Tirith, will do well to leave the great river above Rauros and cross the Entwash before it finds the marshes. Yet they should not go too far up that stream, nor risk becoming entangled in the forest of Fangorn. That is a strange land, and is now little known. But Boromir and Aragorn doubtless do not need this warning."
"Indeed, we have heard of Fangorn in Minas Tirith," said Boromir. "But what I have heard seems to me for the most part old wives' tales, such as we tell to our children. All that lies north of Rohan is now to us so far away that fancy can wander freely there. Of old Fangorn lay upon the borders of our realm,
but it is now many lives of men since any of us visited it, to prove or disprove the legends that have come down from distant years. I have myself been at Wiles in Rohan, but I have never crossed it northwards. When I was sent out as a messenger, I passed through the gap by the skirts of the White Mountains, and crossed the Isen and the Grey Flood into Northerland. A long and wearisome journey. 400 leagues, I reckon it, and it took me many months, for I lost my horse at Tharbad, at the fording of the Grey Flood. After that journey, and the road I have trodden with this company, I do not much doubt that I shall find a way through Rohan and Fangorn too, if need be.
Then I need say no more, said Celeborn, but do not despise the lore that has come down from distant years. For oft it may chance that old wives keep in memory word of things that once were needful for the wise to know.
Now Galadriel rose from the grass, and taking a cup from one of her maidens, she filled it with white mead and gave it to Celeborn.
"Now it is time to drink the cup of farewell," she said. "Drink, Lord of the Galathrim, and let not your heart be sad, though night must follow noon, and already our evening draweth nigh." Then she brought the cup to each of the company, and bade them drink and farewell. But when they had drunk, she commanded them to sit again on the grass, and chairs were set for her and for Celeborn. Her maidens stood silent about her, and a while she looked upon her guests. At last she spoke again. "We have drunk the cup of parting," she said, "and the shadows fall between us. But before you go, I have brought in my ship gifts, which the Lord and Lady of the Galathrim now offer you in memory of Lothlorien." Then she called to each in turn. "Here is the gift of Celeborn and Galadriel to the leader of your company," she said to Aragorn, and she gave him a sheath that had been made to fit his sword. It was overlaid with a tracery of flowers and leaves wrought of silver and gold, and on it were set in elven runes formed of many gems the name Anduril and the lineage of the sword. "The blade that is drawn from this sheath shall not be stained or broken even in defeat," she said. "But is there aught else that you desire of me at our parting? For darkness will flow between us, and it may be that we shall not meet again, unless it be far hence upon a road that has no returning." And Aragorn answered, "Lady, you know of all my desire, and long held in keeping the only treasure that I seek. Yet it is not yours to give me, even if you would, and only through darkness shall I come to it." "Yet maybe this will lighten your heart," said Galadriel, "for it was left in my care to be given to you, should you pass through this land." Then she lifted from her lap a great stone of a clear green, set in a silver brooch that was wrought in the likeness of an eagle with outspread wings. And as she held it up, the gem flashed like the sun shining through the leaves of spring. "This stone I gave to Celebrion, my daughter, and she to hers. And now it comes to you as a token of hope. In this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elessar, the elf stone of the house of Elendil." Then Aragorn took the stone and pinned the brooch upon his breast, and those who saw him wondered, for they had not marked before how tall and kingly he stood, and it seemed to them that many years of toil had fallen from his shoulders.
"For the gifts that you have given me I thank you," he said. "O Lady of Lorien, of whom were sprung Celebrion and Arwen Havenstar, what praise could I say more?"
The lady bowed her head, and she turned then to Boromir, and to him she gave a belt of gold. And to Merry and Pippin she gave small silver belts, each with a clasp wrought like a golden flower. To Legolas she gave a bow, such as the Galathrim used, longer and stouter than the bows of Mirkwood, and strung with a string of elf hair. With it went a quiver of arrows. "For you, little gardener and lover of trees," she said to Sam, "I have only a small gift." She put into his hand a little box of plain grey wood, unadorned save for a single silver rune upon the lid. "Here is set G for Galadriel," she said, "but also it may stand for garden in your tongue. In this box there is earth from my orchard, and such blessing as Galadriel has still to bestow is upon it. It will not keep you on your road, nor defend you against any peril, but if you keep it, and see your home again at last, then perhaps it may reward you. Though you should find all barren and laid waste, there will be few gardens in Middle-earth that will bloom like your garden if you sprinkle this earth there. Then you may remember Galadriel, and catch a glimpse far off of Lorien that you have seen only in our winter. For our spring and our summer are gone by, and they will never be seen on earth again, save in memory." Sam went red to the ears and muttered something inaudible, as he clutched the box and bowed as well as he could.
"And what gift would a dwarf ask of the elves?" said Galadriel, turning to Gimli.
"None, lady," answered Gimli. "It is enough for me to have seen the Lady of the Galathrim, and to have heard her gentle words.
Hear, all ye elves," she cried to those about her, "let none say again that dwarves are grasping and ungracious. Yet surely, Gimli, son of Gloin, you desire something that I could give. Name it, I bid you. You shall not be the only guest without a gift."
"There is nothing, Lady Galadriel," said Gimli, bowing low and stammering. "Nothing, unless it might be, unless it is permitted to ask, nay, to name a single strand of your hair, which surpasses the gold of the earth as the stars surpass the gems of the mine. I do not ask for such a gift, but you commanded me to name my desire."
The elves stirred and murmured with astonishment, and Celeborn gazed at the dwarf in wonder, but the lady smiled. "It is said that the skill of the dwarves is in their hands rather than in their tongues," she said. "Yet that is not true of Gimli, for none have ever made to me a request so bold and yet so courteous. And how shall I refuse, since I commanded him to speak? But tell me, what would you do with such a gift?"
"Treasure it, lady," he answered, "in memory of your words to me at our first meeting. And if ever I return to the smithies of my home, it shall be set in imperishable crystal, to be an heirloom of my house, and a pledge of good will between the mountain and the wood until the end of days."
Then the lady unbraided one of her long tresses, and cut off three golden hairs, and laid them in Gimli's hand. "These words shall go with the gift," she said. "I do not foretell, for all foretelling is now vain. On the one hand lies darkness, on the other only hope. But if hope should not fail, then I say to you, Gimli, son of Gloin, that your hands shall flow with gold, and yet over you gold shall have no dominion. And you, ring-bearer," she said, turning to Frodo, "I come to you last, who are not last in my thoughts. For you I have prepared this." She held up a small crystal phial. It glittered as she moved it, and rays of white light sprang from her hand. "In this phial," she said, "is caught the light of Iarendil's star, set amid the waters of my fountain. It will shine brighter when night is about you. May it be a light to you in dark places, when all other lights go out. Remember Galadriel and her mirror." Frodo took the phial, and for a moment as it shone between them, he saw her again, standing like a queen, great and beautiful, but no longer terrible. He bowed, but found no words to say. Now the lady arose, and Celeborn led them back to the hythe. A yellow noon lay on the green land of the tongue, and the water glittered with silver. All at last was made ready. The company took their places in the boats as before. Crying farewell, the elves of Lorien, with long grey poles, thrust them out into the flowing stream, and the rippling waters bore them slowly away. The travellers sat still without moving or speaking. On the green bank near to the very point of the tongue, the Lady Galadriel stood alone and silent. As they passed her, they turned, and their eyes watched her slowly floating away from them, for for so it seemed to them. Lorien was slipping backward, like a bright ship masted with enchanted trees, sailing on to forgotten shores, while they sat helpless upon the margin of the grey and leafless world. Even as they gazed, the silver load passed out into the currents of the great river, and their boats turned and began to speed southward. Soon the white form of the lady was small and distant. She shone like a window of glass upon a far hill in the westering sun, or as a remote lake seen from a mountain, a crystal fallen in the lap of the land. Then it seemed to Frodo that she lifted her arms in a final farewell, and far but piercing clear on the following wind came the sound of her voice singing. For now she sang in the ancient tongue of the elves beyond the sea, and he did not understand the words. Fair was the music, but it did not comfort him. Yet, as is the way of elvish words, they remained graven in his memory, and long afterwards he interpreted them as well as he could. The language was that of elven song, and spoke of things little known on Middle-earth.
Ai, laurie, lantar, lassisurinen, jene unotime verama allaron. Jene velinte juldar avanier, mi ormarde lisse mirovoreva, andunne pella, vardo telma, nulueni jassen tintilar i eleni, o mario aeretare lirinen. Si mani julma nin en quantova, ansi tintale varda oio losseo, vefania mariat elentari ortane, ar ilie tier undolave lumbule, ar sinda noriello caita mornie, i fal malinna imbemet arhisie, un tupa calacirio miri oiale. Si vanua na, romello vanua, valle mar, na marie, nai hirovalie vallema, nai elie hirova, na marie.
Ah, like gold fall the leaves in the wind, long years numberless as the wings of trees. The long years have passed like swift draughts of the sweet mead in lofty halls beyond the west, beneath the blue vaults of Varda, wherein the stars tremble in the song of her voice, holy and queenly. Who now shall refill the cup for me? For now the kindler, Varda, the queen of the stars, from Mount Everwhite has uplifted her hands like clouds, and all paths are drowned deep in shadow, and out of a grey country darkness lies on the foaming waves between us, and mist covers the jewels of Karakiria forever. Now lost, lost to those from the east is Valimar. Farewell, maybe thou shalt find Valimar. Maybe even thou shalt find it. Farewell. Varda is the name of that lady whom the elves in these lands of exile name Elbereth. Suddenly the river swept round a bend, and the banks rose upon either side, and the light of Lorien was hidden. To that fair land Frodo never came again. The travellers now turned their faces to the journey. The sun was before them, and their eyes were dazzled, for all were filled with tears. Gimli wept openly.
"I have looked to the last upon that which was fairest," he said to Legolas, his companion. "Henceforward I will call nothing fair, unless it be her gift."
He put his hand to his breast.
"Tell me, Legolas, why did I come on this quest? Little did I know where the chief peril lay. Truly Elrond spoke, saying that we could not foresee what we might meet upon our road. Torment in the dark was the danger that I feared, and it did not hold me back. But I would not have come, had I known the danger of light and joy.
Now I have taken my worst wound in this parting, even if I were to go this night straight to the Dark Lord. Alas, for Gimli, son of Gloin.
Nay, said Legolas, alas for us all, and for all that walk the world in these after-days, for such is the way of it, to find and lose, as it seems to those whose boat is on the running stream. But I count you blessed, Gimli, son of Gloin, for your loss you suffer of your own free will, and you might have chosen otherwise. But you have not forsaken your companions, and the least reward that you shall have is that the memory of Lothlorien shall remain ever clear and unstained in your heart, and shall neither fade nor grow stale.
Maybe, said Gimli, and I thank you for your words. True words, doubtless, yet all such comfort is cold. Memory is not what the heart desires. That is only a mirror, be it clear as Heledzarum, or so says the heart of Gimli the dwarf. Elves may see things otherwise. Indeed, I have heard that for them memory is more like to the waking world than to a dream. Not so for dwarves. But let us talk no more of it. Look to the boat. She is too low in the water with all this baggage, and the great river is swift. I do not wish to drown my grief in cold water.
He took up a paddle and steered towards the western bank, following Aragorn's boat ahead, which had already moved out of the middle stream. So the company went on their long way down the wide hurrying waters, borne ever southwards. Bare woods stalked along either bank, and they could not see any glimpse of the lands behind. The breeze died away, and the river flowed without a sound. No voice of bird broke the silence. The sun grew misty as the day grew old, until it gleamed in a pale sky like a high white pearl. Then it faded into the west, and dusk came early, followed by a grey and starless night. Far into the dark, quiet hours they floated on, guiding their boats under the overhanging shadows of the western woods. Great trees passed by like ghosts, thrusting their twisted, thirsty roots through the mist down into the water. It was dreary and cold. Frodo sat and listened to the faint lap and gurgle of the river, fretting among the tree roots and driftwood near the shore, until his head nodded and he fell into an uneasy sleep. Chapter 9. The Great River. Frodo was roused by Sam. He found that he was lying, well wrapped, under tall grey-skinned trees in a quiet corner of the woodlands on the west bank of the great river, Anduin. He had slept the night away, and the grey of morning was dim among the bare branches. Gimli was busy with a small fire near at hand. They started again before the day was broad. Not that most of the company were eager to hurry southwards. They were content that the decision, which they must make at latest when they came to Rauros and the Tindrock Isle, still lay some days ahead, and they let the river bear them on at its own pace, having no desire to hasten towards the perils that lay beyond, whichever course they took in the end. Aragorn let them drift with the stream as they wished, husbanding their strength against weariness to come. But he insisted that at the least they should start early each day, and journey on far into the evening, for he felt in his heart that time was pressing, and he feared that the Dark Lord had not been idle while they lingered in Lorien. Nonetheless, they saw no sign of an enemy that day, nor the next. The dull grey hours passed without event. As the third day of their voyage wore on, the lands changed slowly. The trees thinned and then failed altogether. On the eastern bank to their left, they saw long, formless slopes stretching up and away towards the sky. Brown and withered they looked, as if fire had passed over them, leaving no living blade of green. An unfriendly waste without even a broken tree or a bold stone to relieve the emptiness. They had come to the brown lands that lay, vast and desolate, between southern Mirkwood and the hills of the Emyn Muil. What pestilence or war or evil deed of the enemy had so blasted all that region,
even Aragorn could not tell. Upon the west to their right the land was treeless also, but it was flat, and in many places green with wide plains of grass. On this side of the river they passed forests of great reeds, so tall that they shut out all view to the west, as the little boats went rustling by along their fluttering borders. Their dark, withered plumes bent and tossed in the light cold airs, hissing softly and sadly. Here and there through openings, Frodo could catch sudden glimpses of rolling meads, and far beyond them hills in the sunset, and away on the edge of sight a dark line, where marched the southernmost ranks of the misty mountains. There was no sign of living, moving things, save birds. Of these there were many, small fowl, whistling and piping in the reeds, but they were seldom seen. Once or twice the travellers heard the rush and whine of swan wings, and looking up they saw a great phalanx streaming along the sky.
"Swans," said Sam, "and mighty big ones, too."
"Yes," said Aragorn, "and they are black swans." "How wide and empty and mournful all this country looks," said Frodo. "I always imagined that as one journeyed south it got warmer and merrier, until winter was left behind forever." "But we have not journeyed far south yet," answered Aragorn. "It is still winter, and we are far from the sea. Here the world is cold until the sudden spring, and we may yet have snow again. Far away down in the Bay of Belfalas, to which Anduin runs, it is warm and merry, maybe, or would be but for the enemy. But here we are not above 60 leagues, I guess, south of the south farthing away in your shire, hundreds of long miles yonder. You are looking now southwest across the north plains of the Riddermark, Rohan, the land of the horse lords. Ere long we shall come to the mouth of the Limlight that runs down from Fangorn to join the great river. That is the north boundary of Rohan. And of old, all that lay between Limelight and the White Mountains belonged to the Rohirrim. It is a rich and pleasant land, and its grass has no rival. But in these evil days, folk do not dwell by the river or ride often to its shores. Anduin is wide, yet the orcs can shoot their arrows far across the stream, and of late, it is said, they have dared to cross the water and raid the herds and studs of Rohan. Sam looked from bank to bank uneasily. The trees had seemed hostile before, as if they harbored secret eyes and lurking dangers. Now he wished that the trees were still there. He felt that the company was too naked, afloat in little open boats in the midst of shelterless lands, and on a river that was the frontier of war. In the next day or two, as they went on, borne steadily southwards, this feeling of insecurity grew on all the company. For a whole day they took to their paddles and hastened forward. The bank slid by. Soon the river broadened and grew more shallow. Long stony beaches lay upon the east, and there were gravel shoals in the water, so that careful steering was needed. The brown lands rose into bleak wolds, over which flowed a chill air from the east. On the other side, the meads had become rolling downs of withered grass amidst a land of fen and tussock. Frodo shivered, thinking of the lawns and fountains, the clear sun and the gentle rains of Lothlorien. There was little speech and no laughter in any of the boats. Each member of the company was busy with his own thoughts. The heart of Legolas was running under the stars of a summer night in some northern glade amid the beechwoods. Gimli was fingering gold in his mind, and wondering if it were fit to be wrought into the housing of the lady's gift. Merry and Pippin in the middle boat were ill at ease, for Boromir sat muttering to himself, sometimes biting his nails, as if some restlessness or doubt consumed him, sometimes seizing a paddle and driving the boat close behind Aragorn's. Then Pippin, who sat in the bow, looked back, caught a queer gleam in his eye as he peered forward, gazing at Frodo. Sam had long ago made up his mind that, though boats were maybe not as dangerous as he had been brought up to believe, they were far more uncomfortable than even he had imagined. He was cramped and miserable, having nothing to do but stare at the winterlands crawling by and the grey water on either side of him. Even when the paddles were in use, they did not trust Sam with them. As dusk drew on the fourth day, he was looking back over the bowed heads of Frodo and Aragorn and the following boats. He was drowsy and longed for camp and the feel of earth under his toes. Suddenly something caught his sight. At first he stared at it listlessly, then he sat up and rubbed his eyes, but when he looked again he could not see it any more. That night they camped on a small eyot close to the western bank. Sam lay rolled in blankets beside Frodo.
"I had a funny dream an hour or two before we stopped, Mr. Frodo," he said. "Or maybe it wasn't a dream. Funny it was, anyway."
"Well, what was it?" said Frodo, knowing that Sam would not settle down until he had told his tale, whatever it was. "I haven't seen or thought of anything to make me smile since we left Lothlorien."
"It wasn't funny that way, Mr. Frodo. It was queer. All wrong, if it wasn't a dream. And you had best hear it. It was like this. I saw a log with eyes."
"The log's all right," said Frodo. "There are many in the river. But leave out the eyes."
"That I won't," said Sam. "'Twas the eyes as made me sit up, so to speak. I saw what I took to be a log floating along in the half-light behind Gimli's boat, but I didn't give much heed to it. Then it seemed as if the log was slowly catching us up, and that was peculiar, as you might say, seeing as we were all floating on the stream together. Just then I saw the eyes, two pale sort of points, shiny-like, on a hump at the near end of the log. What's more, it wasn't a log, for it had paddle feet, like a swan's almost, only they seemed bigger and kept dipping in and out of the water.
That's when I sat right up and rubbed my eyes, meaning to give a shout, if it was still there when I had rubbed the drowse out of my head. For the whatever it was coming along fast now and getting close behind Gimli. But whether those two lamps spotted me moving and stared, or whether I came to my senses, I don't know. When I looked again, it wasn't there. Yet I think I caught a glimpse, with the tail of my eye, as the saying is, of something dark shooting under the shadow of the bank. I couldn't see no more eyes, though. I said to myself, dreaming again, Sam Gamgee, I said, and I said no more just then. But I've been thinking since, and now I'm not so sure.
What do you make of it, Mr. Frodo?
I should make nothing of it but a log and the dusk and sleep in your eyes, Sam, said Frodo, if this was the first time that those eyes had been seen. But it isn't. I saw them away back north before we reached Lorien, and I saw a strange creature with eyes climbing to the flat that night.
Haldir saw it too. And do you remember the report of the elves that went after the Orc band?
Ah, said Sam, I do, and I remember more too. I don't like my thoughts, but thinking of one thing and another, and Mr. Bilbo's stories and all, I fancy I could put a name on the creature at a guess. A nasty name. Gollum, maybe?
Yes. That's what I've feared for some time, said Frodo, ever since the night on the flat. I suppose he was lurking in Moria and picked up our trail then, but I hope that our stay in Lorien would throw him off the scent again. The miserable creature must have been hiding in the woods by the Silverlode, watching us start off.
That's about it, said Sam, and we'd better be a bit more watchful ourselves, or we'll feel some nasty fingers round our necks one of these nights, if we ever wake up to feel anything. And that's what I was leading up to. No need to trouble Strider or the others tonight. I'll keep watch. I can sleep tomorrow, being no more than luggage in a boat, as you might say.
I might, said Frodo, and I might say luggage with eyes.
You shall watch, but only if you promise to wake me halfway towards morning, if nothing happens before then.
In the dead hours, Frodo came out of a deep, dark sleep to find Sam shaking him.
"It's a shame to wake you," whispered Sam, "but that's what you said. There's nothing to tell, or not much. I thought I heard some soft plashing and a sniffing noise a while back, but do you hear a lot of such queer sounds by a river at night?"
He lay down, and Frodo sat up, huddled in his blankets, and fought off his sleep. Minutes or hours passed slowly, and nothing happened. Frodo was just yielding to the temptation to lie down again when a dark shape, hardly visible, floated close to one of the moored boats. A long whitish hand could be dimly seen as it shot out and grabbed the gunwale. Two pale lamp-like eyes shone coldly as they peered inside, and then they lifted and gazed up at Frodo on the Eyot. They were not more than a yard or two away, and Frodo heard the soft hiss of intaken breath. He stood up, drawing the sting from its sheath, and faced the eyes. Immediately their light was shut off. There was another hiss and a splash, and the dark log shape shot away downstream into the night. Aragorn stirred in his sleep, turned over, and sat up.
"What is it?" he whispered, springing up and coming to Frodo. "I felt something in my sleep. Why have you drawn your sword?"
"Gollum," answered Frodo, "or at least so I guess."
"Ah," said Aragorn. "So you know about our little footpad, do you? He padded after us all through Moria and right down to Nimrodel. Since we took to boats, he's been lying on a log and paddling with hands and feet. I've tried to catch him once or twice at night, but he is slyer than a fox and as slippery as a fish. I hoped the river voyage would beat him, but he's too clever a waterman. We shall have to try going faster tomorrow. You lie down now, and I'll keep watch for what is left of the night. I wish I could lay my hands on the wretch. We might make him useful, but if I can't, we shall have to try and lose him. He's very dangerous. Quite apart from murder by night on his own account, he may put any enemy that is about on our track."
The night passed without Gollum showing so much as a shadow again. After that the company kept a sharp lookout, but they saw no more of Gollum while the voyage lasted. If he was still following, he was very wary and cunning. At Aragorn's bidding they paddled now for long spells, and the banks went swiftly by. But they saw little of the country, for they journeyed mostly by night and twilight, resting by day, and lying as hidden as the land allowed. In this way the time passed, without event until the seventh day. The weather was still grey and overcast, with wind from the east, but as evening drew into night the sky away westward cleared, and pools of faint light, yellow and pale green, opened under the grey shores of cloud. There the white rind of the new moon could be seen glimmering in the remote lakes. Sam looked at it and puckered his brows. The next day the country on either side began to change rapidly. The banks began to rise and grow stony. Soon they were passing through a hilly, rocky land, and on both shores there were steep slopes buried in deep brakes of thorn and sloe, tangled with brambles and creepers. Behind them stood low, crumbling cliffs, and chimneys of grey, weathered stone dark with ivy, and beyond these again there rose high ridges crowned with wind-writhen firs. They were drawing near to the grey hill country of the Emynweald, the southern march of Wilderland. There were many birds about the cliffs and the rock chimneys, and all day, high in the air, flocks of birds had been circling, black against the pale sky. As they lay in their camp that day, Aragorn watched the flights doubtfully, wondering if Gollum had been doing some mischief, and the news of their voyage was now moving in the wilderness. Later, as the sun was setting, and the company was stirring and getting ready to start again, he descried a dark spot against the fading light. A great bird high and far off, now wheeling, now flying on slowly southwards.
"What is that, Legolas?" he asked, pointing to the northern sky. "Is it, as I think, an eagle?"
"Yes," said Legolas. "It is an eagle, a hunting eagle. I wonder what that forebodes. It is far from the mountains."
"We will not start until it is fully dark," said Aragorn.
The eighth night of their journey came. It was silent and windless. The grey east wind had passed away. The thin crescent of the moon had fallen early into the pale sunset, but the sky was clear above, and though far away in the south there were great ranges of cloud that still shone faintly,
In the west stars glinted bright. "Come," said Aragorn, "we will venture one more journey by night. We are coming to reaches of the river that I do not know well, for I have never journeyed by water in these parts before, not between here and the rapids of Sarn Gebir. But if I am right in my reckoning, those are still many miles ahead. Still there are dangerous places even before we come there, rocks and stony eyots in the stream. We must keep a sharp watch, and not try to paddle swiftly." To Sam in the leading boat was given the task of watchman. He lay forward, peering into the gloom. The night grew dark, but the stars above were strangely bright, and there was a glimmer on the face of the river. It was close on midnight, and they had been drifting for some while, hardly using the paddles, when suddenly Sam cried out. Only a few yards ahead, dark shapes loomed up in the stream, and he heard the swirl of racing water. There was a swift current which swung left, towards the eastern shore where the channel was clear. As they were swept aside, the travellers could see, now very close, the pale foam of the river lashing against sharp rocks that were thrust out far into the stream like a ridge of teeth. The boats were all huddled together.
"Hoy there, Aragorn!" shouted Boromir, as his boat bumped into the leader. "This is madness. We cannot dare the rapids by night, but no boat can live in Sarn Gebir, be it night or day."
"Back, back," cried Aragorn. "Turn, turn if you can." He drove his paddle into the water, trying to hold the boat and bring it round.
"I am out of my reckoning," he said to Frodo. "I didn't know that we had come so far. Anduin flows faster than I thought. Sarn Gebir must be close at hand already."
With great efforts they checked the boats and slowly brought them about, but at first they could make only small headway against the current, and all the time they were carried nearer and nearer to the eastern bank. Now dark and ominous it loomed up in the night.
"All together, paddle!" shouted Boromir. "Paddle, or we shall be driven on the shoals!"
Even as he spoke, Frodo felt the keel beneath him grate upon stone. At that moment there was a twang of bowstrings. Several arrows whistled over them, and some fell among them. One smote Frodo between the shoulders, and he lurched forward with a cry, letting go his paddle. But the arrow fell back, foiled by his hidden coat of mail. Another passed through Aragorn's hood, and a third stood fast in the gunwale of the second boat, close by Merry's hand. Sam thought he could glimpse black figures running to and fro upon the long shingle banks that lay under the eastern shore. They seemed very near.
"Here," said Legolas, falling into his own tongue.
"Orcs," cried Gimli.
"Gollum's doing, I'll be bound," said Sam to Frodo, "and a nice place to choose, too. The river seems set on taking us right into their arms." They all leaned forward, straining at the paddles. Even Sam took a hand. Every moment they expected to feel the bite of black-feathered arrows. Many whined overhead or struck the water nearby, but there were no more hits. It was dark, but not too dark for the night eyes of orcs, and in the star glimmer they must have offered their cunning foes some mark, unless it was that the grey cloaks of Lorien and the grey timber of the elf-wrought boats defeated the malice of the archers of Mordor. Stroke by stroke they laboured on. In the darkness it was hard to be sure that they were indeed moving at all, but slowly the swirl of the water grew less, and the shadow of the eastern bank faded back into the night. At last, as far as they could judge, they had reached the middle of the stream again, and had driven their boats back some distance above the jutting rocks. Then, half turning, they thrust them with all their strength towards the western shore. Under the shadow of bushes leaning out over the water, they halted and drew breath. Legolas laid down his paddle and took up the bow that he had brought from Lorien. Then he sprang ashore and climbed a few paces up the bank. Stringing the bow and fitting an arrow, he turned, peering back over the river into the darkness. Across the water there were shrill cries, but nothing could be seen. Frodo looked up at the elf standing tall above him as he gazed into the night, seeking a mark to shoot at. His head was dark, crowned with sharp white stars that glittered in the black pools of the sky behind.
But now, rising and sailing up from the south, the great clouds advanced, sending out dark outriders into the starry fields. A sudden dread fell on the company. "Elbereth, Gilfoniel," sighed Legolas as he looked up. Even as he did so, a dark shape, like a cloud and yet not a cloud, for it moved far more swiftly, came out of the blackness in the south, and sped towards the company, blotting out all light as it approached. Soon it appeared as a great winged creature, blacker than the pits in the night. Fierce voices rose up to greet it from across the water. Frodo felt a sudden chill running through him and clutching at his heart. There was a deadly cold, like the memory of an old wound, in his shoulder. He crouched down, as if to hide. Suddenly the great bow of Lorien sang. Shrill went the arrow from the elven string. Frodo looked up. Almost above him the winged shape swerved. There was a harsh, croaking scream as it fell out of the air, vanishing down into the gloom of the eastern shore. The sky was clean again. There was a tumult of many voices far away, cursing and wailing in the darkness, and then silence. Neither shaft nor cry came again from the east that night. After a while Aragorn led the boats back upstream. They felt their way along the water's edge for some distance, until they found a small, shallow bay. A few low trees grew there close to the water, and behind them rose a steep, rocky bank. Here the company decided to stay and await the dawn. It was useless to attempt to move further by night. They made no camp and lit no fire, but lay huddled in the boats, moored close together.
"Praised be the bow of Galadriel and the hand and eye of Legolas," said Gimli, as he munched a wafer of Lembas. "That was a mighty shot in the dark, my friend."
"But who can say what it hit?" said Legolas.
"I cannot," said Gimli, "but I'm glad that the shadow came no nearer. I liked it not at all. Too much reminded me of the shadow in Moria, the shadow of the Balrog," he ended in a whisper.
"It was not a Balrog," said Frodo, still shivering with the chill that had come upon him. "It was something colder. I think it was..." Then he paused and fell silent.
"What do you think?"
asked Boromir eagerly, leaning from his boat, as if he was trying to catch a glimpse of Frodo's face.
"I think... No, I will not say," answered Frodo. "Whatever it was, its fall has dismayed our enemies."
"So it seems," said Aragorn. "Yet where they are, and how many, and what they will do next, we do not know. This night we must all be sleepless. Dark hides us now, but what the day will show, who can tell? Have your weapons close to hand."
Sam sat tapping the hilt of his sword, as if he were counting on his fingers, and looking up at the sky. "It's very strange," he murmured. "The moon's the same in the Shire and in Wilderland, or it ought to be, but either it's out of its running, or I'm all wrong in my reckoning. You'll remember, Mr. Frodo, the moon was waning as we lay on the flat up in that tree, a week from the full, I reckon. And we've been a week on the way last night, when up pops a new moon as thin as a nail-paring, as if we'd never stayed no time in the Elvish country. Well, I can remember three nights there for certain, and I seem to remember several more, but I would take my oath it was never a whole month. Anyone would think that time didn't count in there."
"And perhaps that was the way of it," said Frodo. "In that land, maybe, we were in a time that has elsewhere long gone by. It was not, I think, until Silverload bore us back to Anduin that we returned to the time that flows through mortal lands to the great sea. And I don't remember any moon, either new or old, in Carascalathon, only stars by night and sun by day."
Legolas stirred in his boat. "Nay, time does not tarry ever," he said, "but change and growth is not in all things and places alike. For the elves the world moves, and it moves both very swiftly and very slow. Swift, because they themselves change little, and all else fleets by. It is a grief to them. Slow, because they do not count the running years, not for themselves.
The passing seasons are but ripples ever repeated in the long, long stream. Yet beneath the sun all things must wear to an end at last. But the wearing is slow in Lorien, said Frodo. The power of the lady is on it. Rich are the hours, though short they seem, in Carras Galarthon, where Galadriel wields the elven ring.
That should not have been said outside Lorien, not even to me.